This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida passed a grim milestone this week. More than 3,000 people have died from COVID-19. And that comes after the State Department of Health reported more than 2,700 coronavirus cases in Florida. That's the highest single-day count since the start of the pandemic. So is this the second wave of the pandemic that public health experts were warning about? And if so, what do we do now to stop the spread? In Orange County, Mayor Jerry Demings is considering whether to make mask wearing mandatory for certain businesses, and he says it's up to residents to observe social distancing and hygiene guidelines to avoid having to reimpose a stay-at-home order. And we're going to talk more about the second wave and what public health experts are doing to try and mitigate the spread of coronavirus later in the show. First, though, we're going to talk with Rebecca Jones. She's a data scientist who helped create the state's portal tracking coronavirus cases. She was fired, she says, for refusing to manipulate data to make it look like the state's coronavirus numbers look better than they were. Spokesperson for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said Jones, quote, exhibited a repeated course of insubordination during her time with the department, end quote. Well, now Jones has built her own coronavirus tracking website. Rebecca Jones, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joined by 90.7 health reporter Abe Abariah. Abe, thanks for being here too.
Thank you.
You can join the program as well. You can call in with your questions and comments. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can also send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. Well, Rebecca, let me start with you. For listeners who aren't familiar with your story, you helped build the Florida Department of Health's data dashboard. You were fired after telling a reporter that you were asked to manipulate data to make the case for reopening the economy. Just tell us about that. What do you say that you were being asked to kind of manipulate?
Well, at first it was a few things here, a few things there that maybe didn't look that egregious one by one, but added up to a more favorable picture for reopening between how we counted cases, how we counted hospitalization data, removing non-residents from the totals, waiting until we had an epidemiologist able to review the case data themselves before adding the case instead of just, you know, whenever somebody gets a positive test who's not already in the system being added. The thing that I put my foot down on was going into the actual data and changing numbers so that those counties, mostly rural counties, would meet the criteria to reopen when they didn't.
How many people were sort of working on this portal, though? I mean, was it just you and a couple other people, or was it like a big team of folks? Because it's quite a lot of numbers to crunch and put out there, right?
No, it was just me.
Okay.
It was just me from the beginning until I was taken off of it.
And so then this week you launched your own data portal. Talk about the differences, because when you look at it, you know, on the face of it, it looks pretty similar. There are a couple of extra tabs, but what would be the most important differences between your dashboard and the state's dashboard?
Well, one of the big differences is that I show every person who's had a positive test, regardless of what type of test it was. So we're reaching almost 10,000, probably even more this Sunday when they update the data, positive antibody tests. Which mean that those people, the virus could be detected in their system. So we add that. I also don't filter out non-residents who were sick, hospitalized, or died in Florida. Florida doesn't report non-residents in their death data or their hospitalization status, so it looks lower. And I also provide a lot of information that's really important to measuring kind of our system's capacity to deal with another surge, and that's hospitalization data.
Mm-hmm.
So right now in the state of Florida, we have about 1,384 available ICU beds in the entire state. Now that's down from about 250 yesterday.
And as a proportion of ICU beds overall, what is that? Because, you know, ICU, that's like the most extreme cases, right? I mean, ICU beds and wards are where you would go if you had to be ventilated, for example.
Yes. Well, that's, as far as capacity goes, we have the number of available, but the number of licensed is in a separate data sheet that's not generated by the administration or Agency for Healthcare Administration.
Mm-hmm.
I keep forgetting that acronym. It's called ACA. So they're an authoritative source, but that's all I'm using, and they report available beds.
Okay.
But it is important to note that statewide, about 15% of people who have been diagnosed with coronavirus have been admitted as an inpatient to a hospital, and about 20% statewide had been admitted to the ER.
Now, as far as kind of, you know, what you thought should be in the original portal, there was some information you thought should be in there about, you know, like information that states would use, or counties rather, in the state would use to decide when to reopen, right? If you could just sort of go into a little more detail about what information you thought should be on there but maybe wasn't.
So determining the reopening criteria is what we call it, wasn't actually up to me. That was decisions that were made by the epidemiologist on staff. My job was to take the criteria that they had decided and to crunch the numbers and present those numbers to the public. What I was originally asked to do was to take these four criteria, show them on the dashboard, and then build a report card for each county that broke down whether or not they met each criteria. When I presented that to DOH leadership on April, I think it was 25th or 6th, they immediately said they didn't like it because it drew attention to the fact that the vast majority of counties were not ready. So that's something I've added to my dashboard, almost identical to the way that I developed it at DOH, that easily breaks down, does it meet, you know, a decrease in ER visits for COVID for 2 weeks straight? Do we see a decrease in ER visits for influenza for 2 weeks straight? Have cases decreased for 2 weeks straight? Have the percent positive of labs decreased for 2 weeks straight? Those were the four.
Mm-hmm.
And there is only one county at right now that meets all of those criteria.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rebecca Jones. She's a former data scientist who was fired by the Florida Department of Health. She's got her own website tracking coronavirus cases now. You can call in with your comments and questions as well. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's the number. You can also send us a question at WMFE Orlando. And we're also on the line with 90.7 health reporter Abe Abaraya. We're getting a tweet in from Brandon who writes, second wave, we haven't even gotten over the first. Brandon, I think that's something that perhaps a lot of people are thinking about. Abe, what about that? Because we are still kind of in the throes of stage one of this pandemic, right? And kind of how does this surge in numbers fit in with what we know about where we're at in this pandemic?
I mean, the simple fact is it doesn't really matter whether we're in a first surge or a second surge or, you know, it's all kind of semantics. Realistically, what we should be looking at is how is the trajectory going over the last few weeks. And in Florida right now, over the last few weeks, the trajectory is very clearly going up when it comes to the number of new cases. It has not yet translated into the hospital data, which we were talking about a little bit earlier, that we do right now at this point have enough capacity for we do have enough capacity in the ICUs and for hospital beds, but those are lagging indicators. Right now, the number of people who are testing positive is going up. And so, you know, the way that this is going to work is you start having more people who are testing positive, that's going to go up. And then, you know, the percentage of people who end up sick enough from this to end up needing care in a hospital is going to go up. It's the same thing that, you know, you can just sort of predict that a few weeks down the line, the death rate or the number of people who are dying is going to go up as well. Those are very reasonable assumptions to make based on the data we have right now and the trends that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
As
far as the approach of Governor Ron DeSantis and his administration, let's just hear a little bit of tape. Now, he held a press conference where he said Florida would not be closing down again, essentially arguing that the increase in cases is from increased testing. He also said that the increase in cases is from migrant farm workers. Let's just listen to that tape.
We've had community transmission the whole time in different areas. It's not like we didn't have that. I mean, you've had it in Dade, Broward, Palm Beach. You have pockets in Hillsboro that are identifiable. If you look at the positivity there, some other places. So that's always been the case. But in terms of, like, you know, the restaurants have been doing this for, what have they been doing it for? For 6 weeks? I mean, the idea that all of a sudden is the reason, I'm not sure that that's the case. So, no, we're not shutting down. You know, we're going to go forward. We're going to continue to protect the most vulnerable. You know, we're going to urge, continue to advise, particularly our elderly population, to maintain social distancing, avoid crowds. You know, the mask, we basically said from the beginning, if you can't social distance or if you're in a face-to-face, than the masks are recommended. But I see, you know, you don't need to be wearing it if you're going for a jog or you're on the beach. And so some of this stuff can get out of hand. I want to be more reasonable about it.
All right, so that's Governor DeSantis there sort of talking about some of the elements of the reopening and safety concerns. Fact check the governor there. Does that sort of tell you with what you understand about how this pandemic is going?
There's a couple important things to kind of caveat with what the governor is saying there. So, yes, we have had community transmission the entire time, and, yes, we are doing an increased amount of testing. However, the fact that we're getting up around 10% again of positive cases, the percentage of cases, the new cases that are positive is around 10%, that's an indicator that the spread is increasing because we started out higher than that. At one point, you know, up over 10%, up over 20%, depending on where you were looking. And then we got it back down under 5%. That's the good threshold that the epidemiologists talk about, is you want to see 5% or less percent positive. That means you're testing more people than you need to, and therefore, if you're testing that number of people, you can do contact tracing and you can manage that the outbreaks as they come about. Now that we had that threshold met, and now that we're seeing it going up again, is indicative that we are going to see, you know, that there is something going on. That now, one of the things that we can talk about, you know, here in Central Florida, very specifically in Orange County and in Seminole County, the health leaders are very specific that we have seen an increase in people who are testing positive who are 18 to 30 years old, people who are in the college age bracket, and this is very specifically seeming to come from on June 5th, bars were allowed to reopen again, and mm-hmm. we did see bars in Central Florida and Orange County and Seminole County that were reopening, that were welcoming students back to the, you know, to that scene, and now we're seeing about 2 weeks later, we're, you know, and it's a 2 to 14 day incubation time for this. So now 2 weeks later, we are seeing an increase in that population. And when they talk to that population, they're saying, yeah, you know, I did go out to bar X, Y, and Z, and I went there with my friends, and now all of my friends are sick.
Right.
So we are seeing that now. And I did want to play a little bit of tape from Dr. Amish Adalja, who's a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and Infectious Disease. He's also an infectious disease doctor. Let's take a listen to that.
And at the same time, I see that Mayor Demings is, you know, considering mandatory face coverings as a result of this spike in cases at certain businesses. I think he should do it. I think that we should mandate masks and face coverings across Orange County because people aren't listening.
That actually sounds like Carlos Guillermo Smith. I don't think we actually have that.
Yeah,
never mind. But we'll get back to that in a minute. I wanted to come back, though, to our other guest, Rebecca Jones, former Florida Department of Health data scientist. And Rebecca, I'm just wondering, sort of thinking about the credibility of the data that you were working with for the Florida Department of Health, do you feel like your firing may have done some permanent damage to that credibility? And is that going to outlast this pandemic?
I hope not, honestly. The things that I was opposed to doing were eventually done anyway, so I didn't change anything there. But I know the data that they're producing well enough that I feel comfortable putting it on my own website and in context. Now, if there's something going on behind the scenes, you know, we would have no way of knowing that. I would have no way of knowing that even there, if, you know, things are being fudged before the data actually arrives. But we need to be able to trust the Department of Health. We need to be able to trust our officials who are giving this data to us and saying that they're using it to make decisions. For now, the data still shows that the decisions being made are not supported by the science. So that would lead me to think that the data itself is still trustworthy. And I worked with a lot of epidemiologists, you know, all the time at DOH, and they are hardworking, constantly trying to make sure that everything is they're doing is right and appropriate. And I would never think that any of them would ever be involved in something like that. I really do hope that we can trust it going forward. And I'm just trying to provide the information, the exact same information, within the context that I thought was always necessary, and to provide resources for people so they can easily find a testing site or get help or get food boxes or something if they need it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to comment on what Governor DeSantis said about the migrant communities. I'm happy that he's finally giving them the time of day, which is great because those are communities that may be more reluctant to go get tested out of, you know, fear of being persecuted, arrested, or something else. But Florida does not count non-residents in their numbers. So to blame people who are inherently non-residents in the increases of resident cases is extremely inappropriate.
Let me ask about that then. I mean, a lot of the folks you're talking about may, you know, English may not be the first language, and I'm wondering if some of the data that you've been working with, if there could be more effort being made to try and disseminate that in languages other than English, and if you're seeing much of that being done at this point.
Yeah, the day before I was fired, I actually launched a Spanish version of both the mobile and the desktop dashboard. So that was available the day before I got fired, and I don't know if it's still being maintained, but I had put a lot of effort into that and making that available.
Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of live and breathe this data, right? This is your bread and butter. I'm wondering, you know, a lot of Floridians, they may sort of look at this and they say, well, this is some scary numbers. I don't really understand, you know, what I need to know to make sense of it all. So is there one data point you would encourage more people to pay attention to when they, you know, make decisions about their risk, you know, when to go back to work and anything else they may be doing that could put them in contact with people and potentially elevate their risk of contracting coronavirus?
I don't think there's a single data point that should decide for people whether or not they do or don't do something. It's a complex picture. It's extremely nuanced. The information we have is inherently limited to whatever cases DOH receives. So I think what I would say is that within the discrepancies of the data itself, it's obvious that there are so many more cases than what are officially reported. And I would listen to the epidemiologists and the doctors before making any decisions about what is the most appropriate and safe behavior for you and your family.
Have you been contacted by anyone kind of at the county level or local governments, you know, since you left the Department of Health saying, help us out here, we could use some help, or even, you know, businesses sort of wanting to know a little more about how to go forward?
Oh, so many. I get hundreds of messages a day, and I'm trying my best to get through them all. I swear, if you sent me a message and I haven't gotten to it, I swear I'm not ignoring it. I'm just trying to get the system automated so that I can answer all those responses. But yeah, I worked very closely with local county government officials while I was at DOH, and I'm glad to still have their support now, and I've been in contact with a lot of them.
And you've also raised more than $170,000 on GoFundMe for your portal. How long is that going to be able to keep your dashboard going?
Well, that depends on how much we add to it. So I have to buy credits, which is basically money in a digital account to keep the dashboard up and going. I'm currently looking for a job, so it's paying for my time and my bills while I do that as well. And honestly, whatever money I raise, I'll keep doing this for as long as I can financially and as long as the people think that it's necessary. I've actually been speaking with other states about developing a vaccination program. So using the case data and historical data to try to come up with a preliminary plan for how to distribute vaccinations, because we know we're going to initially have a limited supply and we need to maximize the effectiveness. So how many vaccines to send and where to create the biggest impact in preventing the spread. So I've been in discussions with doing that with other states as well, and that might be something that I add to the dashboard eventually.
Well, you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We've been speaking with former Florida Department of Health data scientist Rebecca Jones. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also with 90.7 health reporter Abe Abarai. Abe, stay on the line, and after the break, we'll continue the conversation about the second wave of coronavirus cases, how health experts are responding. Do stay with us. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the second wave of coronavirus cases in Florida and the public health response. We're joined by 90.7 health reporter Abe Abarai. In a little bit, we'll be joined by Dr. Scott Brady, too, to talk about some of the health responses or the responses to this spike in surge in coronavirus cases. I want to hear from you as well. The number is 1-866-338-5252. You can give us a call there. Send us your comments via Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. And, Abe, we were trying to play a bit of tape before the break. I want to go back to that now. We've got some sound from Dr. Amish Adalja, who is a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins University you spoke to this morning. Let's just take a listen to that.
We've been trying to push people to 5% for the absolute maximum that they should tolerate in their state. And when you're getting to the teens and 10% or above, you really are seeing an outbreak that was once under control, losing control. So if you look back at the percent positivity in Florida, there were times when it was very high. And in Florida, they basically reached a nadir of well below 5% in sort of around the end of May. And since that time, you've seen it kind of creep up. And it's not a question of whether or not you're doing more tests. It's a question of, are you testing enough to be able to have an idea, a situational awareness of what this outbreak is doing in a given regional area? And when you see that percent positivity increasing, that tells you that there is something changing, something is going wrong, and you want to get on top of it by increasing your testing, finding those cases, isolating them, looking at their contacts, and really keeping an eye to hospital capacity through the whole process.
Okay, so that's Dr. Amish Adalja, a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security and Infectious. He's also an infectious disease doctor. Abe, just kind of give us some context there. What's the doctor talking about here, and what do we need to be paying attention to?
Well, the thing to pay attention to is that we are seeing the percentage of positive cases go up, and it's not just that we are seeing the percentage of positive cases, you know, start high. It's that we started high and then we went down, which meant that we are getting that testing, you know, more widely available. And we've gotten to a point now where it is relatively easy to go get a test. You are able to go to some of the drive-up locations without an order from a doctor. You don't have to be symptomatic. You know, you are able to go out and get a test. And so we seem to be at a point where we were testing enough that the positivity rate was lower, and now we're seeing it just start to creep back up. And again, this, you know, correlation is not causation. There's a lot of factors in this that we don't know yet, but we do know that we are at a point now where Memorial Day weekend, where we had a lot of beaches that reopened in time for Memorial Day weekend. We're more than 2 weeks past that. We are now approaching the two-week mark past when bars and restaurants were allowed to reopen with indoor seating with higher capacity. So we know that we're at the tail end of that latency period. So we should be, if there's community transmission at these locations, now is the time when we start seeing the cases, and that is what we're seeing. We're starting to see it, particularly with people right now who are on a younger population. The concern, obviously, you know, the outcomes for people who are younger are better than people who are older. That is without question. 55 and up accounts for more than 70% of the fatalities when it comes to COVID-19. We know that, particularly people with comorbid conditions, mm-hmm. especially if it's diabetes, if it's, you know, heart conditions, anything, you know, COPD, anything with your lungs, those things can really, you know, they're correlated with a bad outcome. We know that. Right now, the cases that we're seeing are in a younger population that will probably have better outcomes.
Right.
We don't know what the comorbidities are going to be from this going forward. So we don't know, you know, if you have someone who maybe, you know, they are able to get through this, even if they get very severely sick, they end up in an ICU, if they end up on a ventilator, we know that being on a ventilator causes long-term damage to your
right.
lungs. We know that's been studied extensively over the years. So there are going to be outcroppings of this going forward, even in populations that, you know, we aren't seeing the death rates, you know, be up there. So it is a reason for concern. It is very reasonable to be worried about the increase in cases that we're seeing right now.
Yes. Okay. 90.7 health reporter Abe Abaraya talking about some of the risks associated with exposure to coronavirus at this point in time, what we know. You can call him with your questions and comments too. What do you want to know about, you know, what the risk level is now, what you should be thinking about as you kind of think about reopening a business, going back to work, getting out and socializing again, going to restaurants even. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. We had a call just a moment ago from somebody wanting to know the website for Rebecca Jones. That's the former Florida Department of Health data scientist who was let go from that job a little while ago. Now, that website, if you Google Florida's Community Coronavirus Dashboard or website https://floridacovidaction.com, you can find that information there. I want to bring another guest onto the program now. We're joined by Dr. Scott Brady. He's an internal medicine physician, Senior Vice President of Ambulatory Services for Advent Health Central Florida Division. He's also the President of Advent Health Centricare, and he's in charge of the group that Advent uses to consult with businesses on how to reopen safely. And he was also on the Orange County Economic Recovery Task Force. Dr. Brady, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. So, question from Susan, who writes in by email. I wonder if you could ask the doctor why it is that masks help keep an infected person from transmitting disease but don't protect a healthy wearer from the virus. What's the deal on masks? Because there's a bit of misinformation flying around there.
Yeah, masks actually do both. And so one of the best things that anyone can do to protect themselves and to protect the community is to wear a mask. Obviously, social distancing is very important. Washing your hands, keeping them from your face, very important, but masks especially. And so if you wear a mask, then your air, your cough, your breath, your talking doesn't produce as many droplets into the air, so obviously it's going to protect other people. It does protect you to a certain extent as well, especially if your mask is waterproof. If someone has droplets coming at you, then the mask will protect you. So some studies have been done to say, does it protect the person wearing the mask, or does it protect the other people? And the answer is both.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more we can wear masks, the better off our community is going to be, the better off you're going to be.
And what about the type of mask? Because, you know, we're hearing the N95 masks are the best, but they're a little hard to come by right now. A cloth mask will do something, though?
Yeah, the N95s, those are hard to come by, but also they're not necessary. And so when I'm walking in the community, when I'm around people, I don't wear an N95. So regular surgical masks, even double-layer cloth masks are fine. Those things also help. You know, one of the things we've seen about this virus is in so many people, maybe 40-45%, it's asymptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
And so an asymptomatic carrier, if they're wearing a mask, it significantly reduces what goes from them to the people around them, even if it's a double-layer cloth mask. So you don't have to have an N95 to protect yourself and others around you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Pettywood with Scott Brady, Dr. Scott Brady. He's with Advent Health, and we're talking about the resurgence in cases and coronavirus cases. I want to hear your questions too. What are your thoughts about it? Concerns, questions? 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. With us also, 90.7 health reporter Abe Abaraya. Question coming in from Gina, who writes, when will the anomalously high pneumonia deaths be incorporated into the coronavirus death tolls? These increases are 1,000 times previous year averages in Florida. I'd have to check those numbers, but either way, Abe, I wonder if you have some thoughts on that, about sort of other things we're hearing, like other diseases that, and how those factor in to this.
Well,
it's definitely something. Oh, go ahead.
So the coronavirus in and of itself is infectious. We know that. We don't know if there's any other viruses that can come alongside of that. The coronavirus in and of itself can give you pneumonia. It doesn't need any help from any other virus or bacterial infection.
Right.
And so, well, one of the things that we look toward is even in the fall. So what happens in the fall when the influenza starts to come around? That's going to make even it more challenging to know whether that cough, whether that fever, what's causing that. And so we're going to need everybody to remain vigilant in getting their flu shots and then seeing their provider if they should have any symptoms, especially in the fall when we're starting having a mixture of respiratory-type illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
In the summer, you don't have influenza as much. mostly it's head colds and those things that are going around. Those generally don't give you fever. Those generally don't give you pneumonia or cough.
Abe, what are you hearing about those pneumonia numbers?
Well, the one thing I will say is that, you know, there's a lot of people who are studying this and looking at the general increase in mortality, the general increase in the number of people who are dying. And, you know, the worry is that not only are we seeing an increase in mortality that can't be explained solely by COVID-19, we are seeing it. So we're seeing that. And so the concern is that people are delaying care and they're having bad outcomes from things that may be preventable. You know, people are scared right now to go out and seek health care when they are sick. And, you know, some of these things, you know, a lot of medical conditions are very time dependent. You know, Dr. Brady, I'm sure, can talk about this. He sees it, you know, directly. I mean, if you have somebody with chest pain or with a stroke, you know, it's measured in minutes, not hours, in terms of how quickly you're able to get an intervention started. And that is very directly correlated with whether that outcome is going to be, you know, someone who recovers or if it's going to be someone who does not. And so, you know, there is a concern that we are seeing higher mortality in other areas that maybe cannot be explained solely by COVID-19. It is a concern, and mm-hmm. researchers are looking at it, and you know, not just in Florida, but in other areas across the country as well.
Dr. Brady, I wonder what you make of that, the kind of influence of coronavirus on diseases that you might not otherwise be seeing different numbers and if we weren't in the middle of a pandemic.
You know, we're seeing exactly that. We are seeing, especially 30, 45 days ago when we were in the heart of the first surge, we were seeing a significant decrease in the amount of people coming to Advent Health hospitals with stroke and with heart attack in particular. And that's either because they're not having them or they're delaying being seen. And sure enough, when those numbers started to go down, folks started coming back to the hospitals. We started seeing that they were more sick, that they had delayed the strokes, they had delayed the chest pain, they had delayed bypass surgeries. They had delayed many things that were important. And so we're seeing an increased severity of those things. So we're encouraging folks, it's safe to come to the hospital. Please don't delay those emergency conditions.
I want to just go back to some sound we heard before the break, and actually we might just try and play that again because we kind of got cut off, but there is some pressure growing for local mayors to do more from some folks anyway. You know, if the state isn't doing more, then what are the local mayors doing? And Abe, you spoke to Carlos Guillermo Smith. He represents the UCF area in the Florida House. Let's just take a listen to that tape, if we could.
And at the same time, I see that Mayor Demings is, you know, considering mandatory face coverings as a result of this spike in cases at certain businesses. I think he should do it. I think that we should mandate masks and face coverings across Orange County because people aren't listening.
All right, so that's Carlos Guillermo Smith, a local state representative there who represents the UCF area. Abe, you were reporting the other day on a spike in cases near UCF. Just give us the background on what we were seeing there.
What we're seeing is that, you know, we're seeing the 18 to 30-year-olds testing positive at a higher rate, particularly around the University of Central Florida. The zip code that actually includes part of UCF and then south and east, it's over 90 cases right now. When you look at Seminole County, they're getting 40 cases per day, and you know, for the last 4 or 5 days straight. So we know that this younger demographic is catching it more right now. So obviously the concern is, you know, if community transmission is a problem, and if we start seeing community transmission that's in a different demographic, then that's what, you know, and frankly, Governor Ron DeSantis talked about this. You know, if we started seeing a spike in cases like we're seeing now in a nursing home or assisted living facility, the outcomes would be obviously very different, and that might cause state leaders to act a little bit differently. Now, when it comes to, you know, some of the issues about masks and reopening guidelines, you know, that is something that Carlos Guillermo Smith was very, you know, specific about, because, you know, he told me that he went to, you know, a couple of restaurants that, you know, right now the guideline is you can only open at 50% capacity. And he's like, I went into a restaurant and the 50% capacity meant they shut down the front dining room and the back dining room was completely open and people were not socially distanced. But then you get into this question of how do you enforce it? Who's going in there and talking to a business owner and saying, no, this is, you're not meeting the guidelines. Even if you're meeting the letter of the law, you're not meeting them, you know, you're not meeting the spirit of it and you're not doing the correct public health thing.
Right.
So it starts very quickly going into that rabbit hole of, like, how do you actually get the enforcement to go out there? And it's really important, you know, when people are hearing messages from the government that it's okay to have beaches open, that it's okay to have trails open, that it's okay to do certain things without a mask, you know, public health people kind of raise their hand and go, oh, you know, we want to make sure that people get the baseline message that, you know, you should be socially distancing, even though the numbers are going down, you know, and this was before this recent spike, even though the numbers are going down, you should still be doing these things because there is not a vaccine. We're not going to see one, you know, in any large number in the short term. So right now, the only thing that can be done is to keep yourself away and to, you know, prevent the spread of the virus and very, you know, I'll be honest, you know, it's very difficult. It's weird. I was on a walk with my kids earlier today, and, you know, my son, who's about a year and a half old, dropped his sippy, and there was somebody who was walking by who saw it, picked it up, and was like, hey, is this, you know, your sippy? And, you know, I'm looking at it, and I oh, my God, and I go back, and then I kind of see it on her face, like, oh, no.
Right.
How do I interact with this person? And it's like, I was like, okay, it's okay. You can just set it on the ground. It's okay. Yeah. And you know, these kind of weird interactions are becoming the norm because there's just not anything else you can do right now, unfortunately.
Right. There's a new way of living. And just on the enforcement front, we've heard some reluctance from the mayor of Orange County, Jerry Demings, former sheriff, of course, saying that he doesn't really want to get law enforcement involved, especially at this time. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the second wave of coronavirus cases with 90.7 health reporter Abe Abariah, also Dr. Scott Brady, Senior Vice President of Ambulatory Services for Advent Health Central Florida Division. We'll continue that conversation after the break about how health experts are responding to the pandemic. Dr. Brady and Abe, please stay with us. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the second wave of coronavirus cases in Florida and the public health response. We're joined by 90.7 health reporter Abe Abariah and Dr. Scott Brady with Advent Health, president of Advent Health Centricare. You can call them with your questions and comments, 1-866-338-5252. Send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando is our Twitter handle. Dr. Brady, I mean, you're leading a group that advises businesses on how to reopen safely. What kind of questions do they have for you?
Yeah, the Advent Health team for employer getting back to work has really talked to probably about 85, 95 businesses in the last month about how to get back to work safely. And I've been very impressed. Most of the questions they have revolve around masking, around temperature checks, around hand sanitization, and many of them have policy and procedures that they want us to review. So the idea is that they want to keep their employees safe, as well as their customers as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been really, really impressive. For the most part, the employers that we have worked with are very serious about protecting their employees as well as the guests.
I want to just come back to, you know, one of the things we're seeing is the median age of patients is coming down. I'm wondering, too, I mean, as far as folks kind of walking into the clinics, are we seeing different symptoms? Is it presenting the same? Because these viruses can mutate, right?
Yes, most of the cases we're seeing are presenting exactly the same, even in the younger population. And so, you know, over 50% are presenting with a cough. Sometimes there's some gastrointestinal symptoms to go with it. Sometimes you feel fluey. Most of the times you get a fever, at least by day five, and those are kind of classic symptoms. We haven't seen any variation in the symptoms, although the younger population is more likely now than they were a month ago to be coming in.
Mm-hmm. What about the notion of self-quarantining? We're hearing for a while 2 weeks was a good number. I mean, is there some rationale for that, or anything changed on that front?
No, it's the same thing, except the testing is more available now. And so it used to be when testing wasn't available, you'd just quarantine yourself for 2 weeks. Now the testing is available. Some employers are taking advantage of that, and after a person has had tested positive for COVID, then they will get quarantined, and then they'll get tested before they come back to work to get one or two negative tests before that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's helpful. I do want to get back just a bit to the mask question.
Sure.
Because that's a very, very, very important question. And what we're seeing is that this virus certainly is transmitted by cough. Mm-hmm. But more than that, it's transmitted by the microscopic droplets when you're just talking or breathing as well. Not necessarily aerosolization, but smaller droplets.
Right.
And so when you're in an enclosed space, a room, with another person and you both don't have masks, the longer that you're in there together with that person, the higher likelihood it is that you're going to breathe in whatever microscopic droplets they're giving. And so it's not just the distance is important, but even if you're 10, 12 feet away from somebody and you're in a room for an hour, well, you might as well be right next to them. And so masks are vitally important for that.
Mm-hmm.
The whole question about masks that are mandatory or not, the main thing is to understand how protective they are. I have seen some businesses and some other community gatherings where they're making masks optional. Lots of people are getting there. There's a lot of talking, a lot of being with each other for an hour. That's very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone needs to wear masks. So I just want to make sure we highlight that, how important they are and how much they really do protect you and the community.
Right. I got a call coming in from Booker, who is interested about sort of follow-up once people are tested positive. Booker, you're on the air.
Yes, my question was around the rate of recovery
mm-hmm.
for individuals that test positive and that get sick. I think we hear a lot about the new cases, but I don't think we hear enough about when they recover and what that rate looks like. I know, you know, from I've heard before where they may recover within 5 to 7 days or maybe even longer.
Mm-hmm.
But what is that rate of recovery? And then is there a follow-up antibody test for those individuals?
Booker, thanks so much for your call. Yeah, I wonder if I could throw that question to you, Dr. Brady. What do you know about the sort of recovery rates from what you're seeing so far?
Yeah, that's a great question, Booker. The recovery rates are different depending upon the age of the individual and whether they have other chronic illnesses to go along with their age. And so the recovery rate for the young folks who many times don't even display symptoms is very, very fast. The recovery rate for most people is within 7 to 10 days. We think they're still contagious 14 days out. That's why the quarantine happens. The older you get, the recovery rate, especially if you're older than 65 and you have heart disease and lung disease, those recovery rates are not as high. When you take them all together, it's greater than 96, 97% recovery rate, and it usually happens within a week to 10 days. Again, some people that are older and have concomitant illnesses, those can take longer. If they go to the hospital, they can be there for 2, 3, 4 weeks, especially if they have to get intubated. In terms of the antibody test, yes, you can get an antibody test to see whether you have the immune cell, the IgG or the IgM. Unfortunately, we're not exactly sure what that means right now.
Mm.
There's a lot of variability in folks understanding that. Historically, with other diseases, once you produced an antibody, it was protective for you for long term. We're seeing different things with this virus. Some indications that it may be protective. Other times we see people that will develop the antibody, and then the antibody disappears within 60 to 90 days. We see in some people they don't develop the antibody at all, even after having the virus.
Hmm.
So jury's still out on our antibody test and what it means and whether we're protected and how much we're protected if we do get the COVID.
Question coming in from Brandon. I'm not sure this might be a question for Abe here, but Brandon asks, what about posthumously testing, especially from respiratory deaths starting in February? Abe, are you hearing anything about how to kind of backfill some of that data if there were higher death rates from other diseases?
Well, just practically speaking, I mean, you know, if people died prior to COVID, it's not really feasible to be running tests on them at this point. Dr. Brady might be able to talk to this as well, but I'm relatively confident that at this point, when there are people who are dying with respiratory symptoms, that they are doing posthumous COVID tests. And the reason I'm remembering this is because there have been some cases of people who tested negative multiple times, and then after death, they did a test of tissue that was further down into the lungs, and they were able to get a positive test result at that point. Dr. Brady, I don't know if that's something you can touch on as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And for the most part, again, I can't speak for all folks who die, whether they get posthumously tested. Most of the time, 99%+ of the time, if you're in the hospital and you're having a cough, or if you're ventilated, or if you're really starting to get sick and near death, you're going to have been tested for COVID. It is, in this day and age, it is extremely unlikely that someone with any kind of respiratory symptom is not tested already for COVID, and sometimes multiple times. If the first test comes back negative and there's still a clinical suspicion, they'll be tested again and even again.
And if I can add to that, too, I mean, I know that I've talked to doctors who have said, you know, we have had patients who, despite the negative test, they did have the, you know, when you look at imaging of the chest, it did look like COVID. And so they proceed as though it's COVID, even if there are negative tests, because, you know, the last thing people are wanting to do is to expose healthcare workers to, you know, being in a room with somebody, you know, without enough protective equipment, you know, if that person is one of the ones who might have a bit of a different presentation of COVID-19.
Dr. Brady, I wonder if, you know, absent some of these posthumous tests, like, and this may be outside of your field of expertise, but is there a value in sort of going back and looking at the numbers and kind of looking at some of the records of symptoms that people had and sort of trying to, you know, guesstimate based on those data what the sort of potential, you know, coronavirus cases may have been, even if there wasn't testing done at the time?
You know, where you're going is important and very good. I think probably the most important thing we can start to do to understand that is to do widespread antigen and antibody testing. Mm-hmm. And that's the question is, what is the prevalence of this thing? Is it 4%? Is it 14%?
Right.
How many people are asymptomatic? What does it look like when people die and they test negative? Do they really have it or do they not have it? They do track, we do track, the county does track everybody who comes into the hospital that has any kind of respiratory or what they call ILI, influenza-like symptoms. And so we track that every day to see whether that's going up or whether that's going down. And just like our numbers, the ILI symptoms presenting to our physicians in our emergency rooms has gone up in the last week or so. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I think it will be very helpful when the antibody test is better understood for us to do more widespread testing of our community.
Just in the last minute or so here, Dr. Brady, I wanted to ask, you know, based on, you know, what the advice you've been giving to businesses and your experience as part of the task force, are we going about the reopening the right way? And do you get the sense that down the track there could be a rethinking of how we're reopening and maybe a second shutdown?
Yeah, I don't know about the shutdown. I think the recommendations are good. The task force recommendations were very good. And it had to do with the things we've always talked about, the social distancing, the washing the hands, the temperature checks for employees, the masks for employees. There was also a recommendation of masks for the community. And I think that's the one that's being looked at again. Mm-hmm. And when I go into the community and talk to people who are in the community, that's the one thing, wearing masks, which seems to need a little bit more re-education of our community. I don't think that's necessarily that we need to shut down. I don't think you have to. I think you can actually control this thing by doing the things we talked about, especially wearing masks.
Well, we've been speaking to Dr. Scott Brady. He's the Senior Vice President of Ambulatory Services for the Advent Health Central Florida Division. He's also the President of Advent Health Centricare. Scott Brady, thanks so much for being here.
Yes, pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
You as well. We've also been talking to 90.7 health reporter Abe Abariah. Abe, thanks as well for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Production assistance for today's show from Juan Gualda, Mac Dula, and Abe Abarai. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us online at WMFE.org. You can listen to previous shows on WMFE.org/intersection. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty and follow WMFE at WMFE Orlando. Thanks so much for listening.